a good old V2ZIS, I'm trying to remember him and Young, Eager, and Willing. YEW, Norm Westwood. These guys, every morning, used to talk about a phony contest, work all expressway exits, an award for, you know, earning a living on the radio while driving to work in your car in the morning is what these guys are doing. Okay, over to the person who just called me, K2RIW, listening.
That was V6WS1.
Go ahead, Paul.
You will be able to work two meters on moon, but instead of talking to the Earth, we'll be talking to all those other countries and all those other facilities around the moon, you know. Not too far away, you can't go over the horizon unless you set up a repeater by one of those high peaks. So, there you go, we don't have to talk to the Earth anymore. There's going to be half a dozen lunar bases there that we can speak to. Maybe with some satellites in orbit, we can do some satellite work. Or the other stations that way as well. I want to comment on one more thing about the Mars prospect. The idea of going to Mars is pretty strange for our age, but the younger people, they're going to be the ones pushing for this. For instance, courtesy tell before. For instance, anybody today that's 20 years old or younger has not gone through a day of their life without having signals coming back from Mars. We've been permanently sending signals. We have had many different spacecraft not only orbiting the Mars, orbit sending signals back, but also landed. Back in, 97, we had the Pathfinder mission land there, and had Sojourner riding around, and, we do very good with all this robotic equipment, and many missions after that. You've got two other robotic equipment pieces that are riding around on the moon, Spirit. Opportunity Spirit no longer, but Opportunity still doing it after 2004. So, this is common. Imagine being like 15 years old and somebody telling you about Mars, and they say, well, we get signals from Mars all the time. It's all this robotic stuff. When are we going to go? So that generation is going to push for it. You watch. And, like we pushed for the moon. I know it was a competition between Russia and us. The money that was being poured into it was phenomenal compared to what we put into it today. But now with all these private companies coming up, more and more money is starting to be put in. It's still not a match of the people that are employed. I think it's 100,000 people or something right now, roughly. Back during the early days of the space program, you had 400,000 people working on these missions. And they weren't all government. I mean, government contracts went out to private companies, and that's pretty much what you have today. Now, on July 4th, 20 years ago, you had Pathfinder landing on Mars. That was a big thing, and then again with July 4th, it seemed like a big deal. There's been a couple of other famous missions that have occurred recently. You had the Horizon going in, passing Pluto, 4th of July ago. They've come a long way with the robotic missions. Now, people are going to be pushing for more manned missions. And that's coming have, we talked about recently, all the astronauts that they just brought in into the NASA. Now there's two more. Canada just picked two more people to join the group. And it's going to be, you know, they've had, what, over 500 people that have gone into space. In the next couple of years, next, say, 10 years, I think you're going to match that number with another 500 people. Back to you, Dick.
Be back with you in a minute. I'm finishing a calculation here.
Okay, very good. There's also billionaires, one right after the other. There's one guy, he's come out of Russia, but now he lives in the United States in California. Yuri Milner. And he's pouring all kinds of money into science. Including, not building equipment, you know, although he has one project where he wants to send things to the stars, but he's got the world's most expensive listening, they call it breakthrough, listen breakthrough or breakthrough listen, some kind of a $100 million project he's put forward where he plans on listening to all the stars, bigger than anybody else. You've got these billionaires that are involved. You didn't have that back in the 60s. You know, everything came from the taxpayer, the average guy. Back to you, Dick. Finish your calculation. This is WS2N.
K2LR with two questions.
You open a second, Kay. The Apollo program in 1969 was very close to $33 billion. In 1969, that was 48 years ago. $33 billion then, if you assume that our average rate of inflation is 3%, I don't know exactly what it is, but it's not 1% and it's not 10%. Our average inflation might be in the vicinity of 3% throughout those 48 years. You do that exponential mathematics and the bottom line is $33 billion then is $127 billion today. So in today's money, the Apollo program was $127 billion to go to the moon. Going to Mars is close to 1,000 times more difficult in mileage, dollars, duration, consumable, life-threatening situation, so on. Almost every, a high percentage of the high school students today are dreaming about the day that one of their contemporaries will be standing on Mars. It's a desirable sounding goal to them until they get into the specifics of cost and risk and probability of survival. And even if the person does survive, with all of that exposure for all of those years of cosmic rays, solar wind, and everything else on the way there and the way back, what you're getting back, if he's still alive, is that still a human being with all of his, with all of the maladies he's going to pick up because of that exposure? Again, I'm a little afraid of being too negative, but you've got to know where the degree of difficulty is. Some of these things are solvable, not all of them. Kay, go right ahead, and I know you've got at least a couple of questions. You got it, ma'am. K2LIW.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Paul. So I'll just give you both, and then these are both questions for Paul. You can tackle them in any order if you'd like. The first one is, how do they land the booster rockets exactly on those tiny moving barges? Like, I'm sure the barge is bouncing around in the waves, right? And is it, you know, kind of like the, they have auto-land systems for airplanes? And the other question is, how do we measure temperature on the moon? If we're measuring infrared radiation with thermocouples, how do we cancel out for the ambient temperatures around thermocouples? This is AC2LR, and back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've got a partial answer to the second. And when it comes to the first question, over to you, Paul. WS2N, KGRIW. I'm guessing GPS has a lot to do with this.
Yeah, it does. And now they're using the same GPS that are on the first stage, and they have an interstage, and the interstage has all the computers, the interstages between the first stage and the second stage, that guides everything back and forth, up and down, and they use the GPS to go back to that barge. The barge does not send the signal. I found that just recently, so I was always looking into that as well. The barge does not send the signal to the first stage at all. It knows where the first stage is. It's receiving information before it goes up, and as it's flying, the transmissions from the satellites coming down, and it picks that up on their antennas and goes into their computers. They know exactly where that barge is. That's really how they're doing it. And then they when they come down, they use the guiding fins that are sticking out of this four of them that come out. That guides it down, and then they have nitrogen jets on top, pushing the top of the rocket either left, right, one way or the other, keep it straight. And it has nine rockets when it takes off, nine Merlin D rockets when it takes off, and as it's flying along, it separates from the second stage. It does a 180, and it does that using these nitrogen jets. It does a 180, drop it. It advised that three engines slow itself down, and go actually in the other direction. Or, in the case of a barge, it slows itself down so it can drop into the atmosphere. It also has been designed to go back to land and land on Launch Complex 13. Landing Zone 1, it used to be called Launch Complex 13. It renamed it to Landing Zone 1. And they land right on the money when it comes back to land. The boat, you're probably wondering how to stay so stable. They have these four massive propeller systems that are being driven by diesel engines, or electric engines. Diesel engines are running electric motors, so it's diesel over electric. And the four motors turn 360 degrees under the boat, one on each corner. So that keeps the whole platform stable. And for elevation, you can have waves up to 20 feet. They've designed it. If the waves are up to anything minus 20, they would have to scrub the launch. So, the accuracy of this thing is phenomenal. Then when it comes back down through the atmosphere, the re-engines fight again, slow it down more. It looks like about 15 seconds, not long. And then right before they get to the barge, the center engine comes on only. And that's also gimbal. You could pull that engine one way or the other to help it land on the barge. Some of the earlier flights, when you had long distance cameras, you could see that the plane was skewed from the bottom one way or the other as it was trying to keep itself upright before it landed on the barge. And they're doing it, and it also Blue Origin, when they stopped flying New Glenn, that rocket is, it looks like about as almost as big as the Saturn V rocket, not quite, but it's getting there. And that first stage will also come back on their own barge, but we'll have to wait until probably, they used to say 2019, but it looks like 2020 before we see the first New Glenn rocket launch from Launch Complex 36 in Florida. They've taken over that complex. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
that are diesel and electric on the four corners of the barge. Is that doing station keeping? In other words, there is a, I'm guessing that there is a designated address in exact latitude and longitude where the barge is supposed to be at the time that the first stage is going to come back and land on it. So I'm guessing there's a place it's got to hold itself to, and there's probably signals being sent from there to the spacecraft that, because the wind is blowing so fast, we can't make this address, but we can make this address, so adjust yourself accordingly. So it sounds to me like the first attempt is to put the barge at a very specific address, and that becomes the bullseye that the spacecraft is landing, is aiming for when it lands. Is that approximately true, Paul? Address 2N, K2IW?
Yes. This way, as far as the first stage is concerned, it's going to a very specific location. Just like when it comes back and lands on landing zone 1 on, they have a bullseye with space experts right in the middle. And every time they've landed there, it's right on the money. By the way, they've also taken over Launch Complex 3. Three west or four west on in California. So they'll be landing on the west coast as well as soon as they get clearance from the FAA to do that. I think that's coming up soon. But right now they have a barge on the west coast and then they have another barge on the east coast to handle both landings. It's exactly, they keep it exactly in one location. The earliest flight, the first one that they ever caught, they sent a cargo Dragon vehicle up to the space station. And that was, they don't need as much power to do that. So they only kept the barge about 200 miles out to shore. And they successfully landed it on the barge. And then soon after that, any of the those particular flights will be coming back to Cape Canaveral. Last couple of them like that. They come right back to Cape Canaveral. But the ones that go out to geosynchronous orbit, which are, they don't have enough fuel to come back all the way back to Florida to do a boost back or in that bar. So they come down on these barges. Geosynchronous, they have to go faster, higher, before the second stage separates. That's why they do what they do. Probably within 4 or 5 months, we'll see Falcon 9 Heavy, they call it now a Falcon Heavy, change the name. It's really 27 engines. It's three Falcon 9s bolted together that have been taking off at one time from Launch Complex 39A. And they plan on bringing those stages back as well. The two side stages, one on the port and the starboard side, will come back to land and land at Launch Complex landing zone 1. And then the center stage will continue. That core stage will keep going back to land on the barge like they're doing now. So all three will be returned. And of course, the final stage will continue and bring the payload to orbit. That's pretty much it. Back to you.
When it comes to global positioning satellite receiver positioning, there is the civilian GPS and there's the military GPS. The military GPS, which has got a special code that only certain people are allowed to use, gives you at least 10 times more accuracy. So if Musk had the authorization, and I think he does, to use the military version of GPS, that can get him down to a target within a couple of meters, maybe better than that. And then the barge itself has a bullseye on it. Is there any possibility that the last couple of hundred feet, there's really a camera on board making sure that the spacecraft is looking for the center of that bullseye? Is any optical tracking at the end of that landing sequence, do you think, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
No, they don't have that. They have cameras on board looking down, and you can see the barge as it's coming down, or you can see the bullseye in Cape Canaveral when it's coming down, landing on land, but no, they're not doing any optical stuff. I've never heard that they are. It's all GPS. And now they're using the same GPS system to use that for a possible abort. They wanted to drop and take off, and they go, start going over land, and, they don't want it to, crash into a one of the millions of condominiums down there. So they have it set up where the GPS now will detect if it's off course, and it will blow up the whole rocket. They said you said have to do that with radar, and, from Merritt Island, they would have radar systems, all kinds of people involved, tracking this thing, and if it went off course, they would transmit a signal and blow it up. They don't have to do that anymore, which is good because they plan on launching three of these rockets at one time. They got to be able to bring them back down. It would be too hard of a job to use radar to be tracking two or three of these things at one time as they're flying not only up into space, but when they're coming back. So they've eliminated that problem when they're coming back. If one or two are off course, they will self-destruct. WS2N back there.
Now, Kay's second question was with reference to temperature. And I'm not an expert in this area, but I'm going to tell you what little I know about temperature. The air molecules in the room with you right now, Kay, are moving an average of 500 meters per second. That's the average speed of the individual air molecules in your room if they're at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, which, by the way, is 1.5 times the speed of sound. It's the average speed of the air molecules. Those air molecules are banging against the bulb on the bottom of your thermometer and transmitting a certain amount of vibrational energy through that bulb into the mercury, and therefore the temperature of the air and the temperature of the mercury becomes essentially the same. The air, the mercury is a liquid, the air is a gas. And you could take your thermometer and you could lay it against a chunk of steel and measure the temperature of the chunk of steel. You're going to say, well, wait a minute, the chunk of steel, those molecules are not flowing anymore. But yes, they are. Each of the individual molecules of the chunk of steel are all attached to the adjacent molecules as if they're a bunch of balls on springs. And so there is definite subatomic motion. The individual molecules of the steel are shaking back and forth on their springs, depending on temperature. And so you can measure the temperature of the steel by the vibration of those steel molecules, coupling their vibration through the glass of the bulb into the mercury, and therefore that's how temperature is communicated. Temperature is average kinetic energy of motion of those molecules. Let me drop them. And if you take your thermometer outside and put it in the direct sunlight, so the sun is shining on your thermometer, you'll start reading 10 or 15 degrees approximately higher than the real temperature of the air. The direct sunlight is now overpowering the situation. And the extra temperature done by the sun is being cooled to some degree by the air molecules that are hitting it. So there's some kind of an average between the two. But now you put your thermometer in a vacuum environment of the moon. You can put your thermometer in contact with the lunar soil, and you can measure the temperature of the lunar soil. You could aim your thermometer at the sun. You're going to come up with a big high number, probably 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Or put it in the shadow of your spacesuit and aim it at the black sky, and you'll measure some very cold temperature. Sterry Musgrove had that problem during the time he's doing that very long spacewalk to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. And the sun and the spacecraft is going around the sun once every 90 minutes. So he's 45 minutes in the sun and 45 minutes in the dark. Let me drop. time he's in the dark, and he's on the backside of the Hubble doing his repair, and he's really concentrating on that because he did a very careful practice to take what was supposed to be two shuttle missions and squeeze it all into one mission in order to do the complete repair of Hubble, that very first repair, and put Hubble back on the air. His glove got so cold that all of his fingertips got so cold with frostbite. He has no feeling in his fingertips. I listened to that lecture he gave to the Astronomical Society of Long Island. He gave it at the Air and Space Museum. And we saw him face to face. He gave us a special lecture. But he told us he has no feeling in his fingers anymore because of how cold it was during that mission. So your thermometer on the moon, if you put it in contact with something, you can measure the temperature. But there is no air molecules on the moon, so if you just aim it at the sun or aim it at a shadow, you'll come up with some pretty high and pretty low numbers. Yes, you could use one of these infrared-type thermometers and aim it at objects that you want to measure the temperature of. I'm pretty sure that would work in the vacuum of space. So that's some of what I think I know about temperature measurement on the moon. I'm back to UK, KQLIW.
I was wondering how we knew the temperature of the moon before we went there. So from a distance, we were able to cancel out whatever the ambient temperature was around whatever the measuring device was in order to see what the real temperature of the surface of the moon was in moon daytime. And then if we... Yeah, okay, that's it. So that's you. Thank you, LR.
WS2N.
Paul Rickenheim, AC2LR. What the average person doesn't know is that every one of the Apollo landings was done at a very carefully chosen spot. At that spot on the moon, at that time of the month, each one of those landings was at a spot that you would call it the early morning on the moon at that spot. The lunar day is 27 days long in sidereal time. Let's make it 28. 14 days of high noon and 14 days of midnight, so to speak, on the moon. High noon is a ridiculously high temperature, like 150 degrees centigrade, way beyond life-threatening. You can't survive that. And lunar midnight is some number like minus 200 and something degrees centigrade, so damn cold that you can't generate enough heat with your heaters on board to keep from freezing the astronauts. So every one of those lunar landings was at a carefully chosen spot midway between nighttime and daytime where the temperature was something like 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And you could only put the astronaut there for a couple of days because as the sun is rising on that spot, it's starting to get hot. You can't stay there. So when you're... Let me drop... Now, what temperature does the spacecraft, the space suit, see? If you look at all four pi star radians, if you look at the total sphere of observable space around the spacesuit, half of all of that sphere is looking at lunar soil. The other half of that spacesuit is looking at dark sky. The half looking at lunar soil is going to see the temperature of the moon, which hopefully is around 70 degrees Fahrenheit, approximately, at that time of day on the moon. So the average of your spacesuit, one side of your spacesuit is running pretty warm, the other side is kind of cold, and the astronaut is wearing this fancy piece of underwear with a whole bunch of channels of water running through it to keep his whole body at one temperature. Without that, half of his body would be cooking, the other half would be freezing, so to speak. So you've got some ridiculous temperature problems when you don't have an airy environment. The air does a beautiful job of balancing temperature. All those air molecules running around, hitting your body billions of times per second. Each individual air molecule, moving at 500 meters per second, strikes another air molecule 8 billion times per second. and they all are sharing their average kinetic energy, which really means temperature. That's why air in the room pretty rapidly tends to come to one particular temperature. Yeah, sometimes you get hotter air on top of the room and colder air at the bottom, but the temperature difference in the complete Kelvin scale is a rather small difference. WS2N, K2R, that'd be very cool.
Yeah, okay, as far as the temperature, the estimate of the temperatures, the scientists figured that out, you know, they knew it was probably going to be about the same amount of heat. You know, the sun has, what, 1300, what is it, BTU for every square meter or something. But they knew the number. So they can figure out roughly what the materials are and what the temperatures would be in the sunlight. They know what cold dark space is like. But to get the actual measurements before humans actually went there, you know, we first had the ranger missions. Ranger missions used to just fly from Earth to the moon and eventually crash into the moon. They'd take as many different measurements and pictures all the way right down until the last meter before they would hit the moon. And then they had the orbiter missions. Another half a dozen of those, we call them orbiters. And that's what they were called, just orbiter missions. And they, of course, looked for eventual landing spots, up close views, you know, 60 miles above the surface. But then you had survey missions that landed in different locations around the moon. And of course they wanted to see if they could land properly. You know, they came down to, you know, with a rocket underneath and just landed. And everyone that went for the moon landed successfully. So you had those things actually not only taking pictures, proving that you could land, digging up soil, but also...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I was going to say that they were all taking really hot and cold measurements on the surveyor mission.
You can measure the temperature of the moon easily with a good radio telescope. Ain't that crazy? Let me drop it. Every absorptive object, and the lunar soil is quite absorptive at radio frequency, every absorptive object has something called black body radiation. With a good sensitive radio telescope, that the antenna is connected to a kind of receiver called a radiometer, you can measure the temperature of something by the amount of radio noise it creates. When I was setting up that 12-foot dish to listen to the Apollo astronauts, and I had a good low-noise parametric amplifier connected to that feed horn, and I had the dish aimed up into the sky at a 30-degree angle, and the radiometer receiver was connected to that feed horn, I wanted to adjust the position of the feed horn. I went and got myself a wooden chair, put it in front of the dish, stood on the wooden chair, and reached up with my hands to touch the horn, to move the horn. The person who was watching the receiver says, you just pegged the needle. It has a signal strength meter. The microwave radiation at 2 gigahertz coming off of my body into that very sensitive dish and receiver system pegged its S-meter by the amount of 2 gigahertz signal coming off my body, because my body is roughly 300 degrees Kelvin, but the dish is aimed at cold sky at 3 degrees Kelvin. I was, as far as that radio telescope of mine was concerned, I was this glowing white object standing on a wooden chair in front of the dish. Another experiment I did is I aimed that antenna through a sheetrock wall. I could easily tell if there was a human being on the other side of the sheetrock wall by the amount of 2 gig signal that would be radiated by that human being, because it's a warm object on the far side of the repeater.
Time out.
I could easily measure the radiation coming off your body. So, depending on the temperature of the moon, as you aim your radio telescope at various portions of the moon, within a couple of degrees of accuracy, you know the temperature of the moon by the amount of radiation at that frequency you're tuned to that emits, because it's a black body radiator. That's what a radio telescope does. It literally measures the apparent temperature of every one of those stars you aim at. That's what your radio telescope picture of the universe looks like. AT2LR, KQLRW, go ahead. I've forgotten your name.
This is AT2LR. Thank you. Thank you, both of you gentlemen. I was just looking up also how they measure temperatures of Jupiter, Venus, exoplanets, and there's a whole bunch of, they're kind of guessing in some sense. And also, Paul, while you were talking about the landing on the barge, I went on YouTube. There are some really cool videos of the booster rockets landing on the barge from the barge's perspective. When you said the barge has cameras on it, I figured I'd take a look. Some of the videos have 2 million views. So, thank you. I think my questions are somewhat answered. I still want to find out more about how we find the temperature on different planets and exoplanets, but I don't want to beat the question to death. So, back to you, Dick. This is AT2LR.
Yeah, that parameter you were looking for earlier, Paul, at high noon, the sun gives you 1,300 watts per square meter. That's the solar flux power density. So the sun is radiating 10 to the 27 watts continuously. It's at something like 5,000 degrees Kelvin. It's radiating 1 with 27 zeros. That number of watts is coming out of the sun. And by inverse square law, where we are out here 93 million miles away, each square meter, if you had a really black object that absorbs every bit of that sunlight, and you got 1 square meter of it, and you aim it at right angles normal to the sun, at high noon, that sun is giving you 1,300 watts for each square meter. You can boil that into BTUs per square meter, but no, watts per square meter is the easiest unit. BTUs is the wrong unit. BTUs per hour can be converted to watts. How many nanokilomegabucks are we talking about here? Units of fun. By the way, I think I've asked you that question once before, Paul. How many nanokilomegabucks do you have in your pocket right now? WS2N, KQRIW with a crazy question.
Not enough. Not enough. And how many megabucks is it going to cost to send these people to Mars and the moon? But, all the different conversions, all the different things. Well, that's what got a couple of ones in trouble. That was the Mars Climate Orbiter and the Mars Polar Lander. Climate Orbiter was lost because of the difference between, they said, between the metric and the American system. That was the final report on that. I still have some doubt about that. I mean, I just thought everybody used the metric system in that world. Back to there.
Okay, you made it sound like we've only answered some of your questions. You must have at least one more. And we've got a couple of minutes, so you've got this opportunity. AT2LR, K2LRW, great case.
Thank you, Dick. I'm just thinking about how they know the temperature on all different planets. And I know, I guess we use spectroscopy, right, to find out what the atmospheres are made of. And then based on knowing what's in the atmosphere, if there is one, then we can, and we know how much, at least in our solar system, we know how much radiation is heading towards the planet, right, because we know how much energy is coming out of the sun and how far away the planet is. And then you can measure the amount of infrared radiation coming off of the planet. Is that what tells us the temperature? Back to you. This is AC2LR.
Every star that you aim your radio telescope or your optical telescope at has a certain amount of brilliance. That brilliance, how bright is that star? Tells you the combination of how big it is and how hot it is. So how bright it is really tells you how many watts it's radiating. Our sun is radiating 10 to the 27 watts, 10 to the 27th hour. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. That amount of radiation is, by definition, isotropic. It's a spherical object radiating the energy equally in all directions, north, south, east, west. In every direction, it's putting out the exact same amount of power. A very slight variation because of sunspots, but don't worry about that. That amount of power creates a certain radius away from the sun that is the so-called Goldilocks zone. If you're as close to the sun as Venus, you're going to start running pretty hot. If you're as far from the sun as the Earth, you're going to be running at a very nice temperature. If you're as far from the sun as Mars, you're going to be running kind of cold. And Mars is cold and Venus is hot. Not only because of the distance, but because of the nature of the local atmospheres. So, the Goldilocks zone, how many miles away from each star is the place where the planet will have the right temperature? You have to wait a billion years for the temperature of the planet to settle down. But each of these planets, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. Let me drop it. So you could assume that most planets have been in their location long enough that they settle down to the temperature of that zone. So once you know the size of the star and the brightness of the star, the combination of the brilliance and size, you know where the Goldilocks zone is. You're measuring the period of each one of these exoplanets. Period tells you how big is the orbit. How big is the orbit tells you how far away it is, and therefore you can easily select the ones in the Goldilocks zone. Therefore, you can come to a pretty good conclusion with some accuracy problems. Roughly, what's the temperature of the planet going to be? And will it be at the right temperature where water will be in the liquid form? We believe that water is a strong requirement for life as we know it. And liquid water is required. You're not going to get anywhere near as much life if the water is in the form of ice or if it's in the form of steam. So that helps you on the temperature. When it comes to what does the atmosphere of the planet consist of, that's a bit more difficult. Let me drop it. When you aim your telescope at the planet when it's off to one side of the star, of its local star, to some degree you can measure what you think is the temperature of the planet, but you've got a huge problem. The star is millions of times brighter than the light coming from the planet. It's a little bit equivalent to having the headlight of a car aimed at you, and there's a mosquito in the headlight, and you want to measure the temperature of the mosquito in the presence of the headlight. I mean, the headlight is so much stronger than the light coming off the mosquito. You can see how difficult that measurement would be. You've got sort of a problem like that with a planet in front of a star. But as the planet goes in front of the star, and you're looking at the spectrum coming out of the planet, you look at how much hydrogen, oxygen, whatever, the strength of each one of those lines of that spectrum. And as the planet goes in front and the atmosphere of the planet blocks some of those components with a whole bunch of Kentucky windage, you can make an estimation of what you think the atmosphere of the planet might consist of. That's what little I know on that one. You probably got some more about this planet, this one, Paul. So how do they determine the atmosphere that's on an exoplanet? WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, they do the estimates. That's pretty much it. But yeah, you have to know the brightness of the stars. And then they go from that, and they know what type of star it is, how much heat it's giving off, and then they know how far the planet is away from that star, and they can deduct roughly, you know, I can't say they're guessing what the planet is. When we have James Webb Space Telescope go up there next year at the L2 position, and they start looking back at some of these planets and that thing, and you'll be able to, they'll take the light from the star as it's going through the atmosphere and evaluate it with spectroscopes. They'll be able to figure out what the atmosphere is made of, and then they can get a good idea of actually what the temperature is on the land of those planets. That's pretty much it, as far as I know, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, let me show you some nice big numbers you can have fun with if you like big numbers, okay. 10 to the 27 watts is coming out of the sun day in and day out for the last 5 billion years, roughly. The sun is going to last approximately 10 billion years. Each watt of power really is 1 joule per second. So the sun is going to last for 10 billion years. 10 to the 27 watts coming out of it, 10 to the 27 joules every second. A year consists of pi times 10 to the 7 seconds. And you multiply that by 10 billion, you come up with a big number. You multiply that by 10 to the 27, you come to the conclusion that in the total life of the sun, the total amount of energy it's going to create before it dies is 10 to the 44 joules. One with 44 zeros after it is the number of joules, the number of watt seconds our sun is going to create in 10 billion years. Let me drop. 10 to the 44. They're not quite sure what the heck it is, but a couple of times per year, our radio telescopes will measure a gamma ray burst. How strong is a gamma ray burst? In some cases, you locate what the source was, you know how far away it was, and you calculate how much power was that burst. And sometimes the gamma ray burst lasts for 1 second. Some of those gamma ray bursts are an amount of energy of 10 to the 44 joules in 1 second. In other words, the total power that our sun puts out in 10 billion years, Mother Nature, a couple of times per year, something goes on in space where she will produce that amount of energy out of one object in 1 second. 10 billion years of energy can come roaring at you at 1 second. Thank goodness almost all of those are in some other galaxy far away from us. If one of those events took place within 22 light years of where you are, it cooks all life on the planet. It's gone. That's a blast. HC2LR, K2LIW.
We really are so lucky to be living near a nice, stable star, aren't we? Back to you, Dick. This is AC2LR.
You're absolutely right. You can look at it that many ways. You could say that a deity arranged that for us. Somebody is really on our side. That's one way of looking at it. You might be right. Another way of looking at it is that star was not that stable for 5 billion years, heating up this planet for 4.5 billion years. If that condition didn't exist, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have a chance to talk about it. So, it's sort of a chicken and egg problem. If a stable star creates Earth and life on it, did a deity set it up for us? Maybe it's some combination. We'll never get to the bottom of that one. We've only got a few minutes left, Paul. We're in 7 minutes of the computer being shut down and the tech yet ending. Any final things that you think we should talk about? Any good-looking launches that are coming in the next week or so? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, it's quite a few worldwide, but tomorrow it's going to be a good launch, but then I'm going to have a landing with one that's going to go up tomorrow, but taking off kind of the SpaceX. And I just want to tell you to say, if you look up CRS-11, stands for Cargo Resupply Number 11. It's a NASA flight put up by SpaceX, and that landing was just beautiful what they do. You watch that whole landing as it's coming back. That's the CRS-11. Click on that. Really, really good. Beautiful scene of the landing zone. That's when they come back to Cape Canaveral. Water in the background. It's really cool. Back to you.
Paul, did you aim your antenna a little bit or lower your power a little bit? You're very slightly noisier. A little bit more hesitant on that last transmission. Now back to you, Paul.
Earlier tonight, I saw it open, so I put it on. I dropped the power, but now I'm back up to 75 watts. But I don't know if I came through. If anybody wants to check out, if they want to check out, CRS number 11, Cargo Resupply number 11. It just went up to 2/3. So, you know, booster, massive booster. They have close up views of the coming through here, through the atmosphere. A couple of different views that come down and land on the landing field that they have in Florida to come with.
We heard every word, Paul, don't worry. There's a little bit of hiss in the background on the last two transmissions that wasn't there earlier. So something has changed. And maybe it's the propagation, and maybe it's nothing to do with your equipment. This was TechNet number 1657. That was space report number 257. I'll give you guys one last chance. Any other questions on any subject of all of the above? Give me a call that is right now, and if not, we're going to sign off a little bit early. K2RIW listening.
AC2LR, I'm looking on YouTube right now. It is indeed a very cool video, the SpaceX Falcon 9 CRS-11 launch and landing. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, and thanks, Dick. This is AC2LR.
What, did you do that by Google, and what search word did you use to find that, Kate?
I went on to YouTube.com, and then I just searched at the top of YouTube, CRS-11, and it came up as the first video.
That's the one with the double screen.
Paul asked, is that the one with the double screen?
Just one single screen.
Okay, you gotta bring up CRS-11. Well, maybe that has everything. Just put in CRS-11, and one of the choices that you're gonna have is you're gonna have to click on YouTube. It's gonna just say CRS-11, such as NASA. Click on that.
Will do. Thank you. AC2LR.
Yeah, but they'll give you the double screen. They'll give you the second stage going to orbit, and they'll give you what's going on with the first stage. And then right at the end, you'll see both screens that switch to the landing as you land. They do a good job. SpaceX is really getting good with it. 73 today.
And those YouTube videos, some of them are extremely educational. And you can get hooked on them going from one to another. And you can easily spend an awful lot of hours looking at YouTube videos. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. See you guys next week. K2RIW clear.
I'll be sure and sign in next week with a good question for you. Peace, YY.
Yeah, go easy with us, Joe. Some of the questions you've asked in the past keep us going for an hour and a half.
antennas, Joe. Remember that one.
Now, this one will have to do with RF cable shielding. There you go. They have a hint.
And we're going to be getting into the electromagnetic compatibility, electromagnetic interference, and vocabulary when you get into that one. Bye-bye for now.
And be kind to everybody.
Next, tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2CL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2CL repeater.
Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.